Hello.
Hello, Robert.
Yeah.
Hello, it's Simon Oster Thompson from scoop.co.nz here. I'm just
yeah, fine. Sure, I know.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much firstly for talking to us.
Oh, don't worry, I'm here for that.
You're very busy, I can see.
Yes, of course, don't worry about it.
One of our correspondents, John Stevenson, says hello. He and Rebecca recently interviewed you in Lebanon in a taxi on the way to the airport.
That's right, and indeed, John and I had lunch yesterday together before he set off for Britain for this court-martial.
Oh, excellent. Well, that's nice. Now, this interview is being recorded,
right?
So we'll probably put it up as a live stream, so just so that you...
It doesn't mean much to me. I don't use the internet, but not to worry.
Okay, well, that's one of the questions I was going to ask you later. But okay, well, first of all, I'd just like to ask a couple of questions about the war in Iraq and the build-up to it.
Sure.
Recently, in the last few months and so, there's been the Downing Street memos have emerged, and then there was the reports about the meeting between Bush and Blair where... Bush apparently suggested that he bomb Al Jazeera's headquarters in Qatar.
Yeah. Qatar.
Qatar. Yeah. Has that changed your views at all about what happened in the build-up to the war, these revelations?
No, you know, you've got to realise Al Jazeera was the target of a cruise missile at the end of the American bombardment of Afghanistan, presumably because it broadcast bin Laden's tapes. And an American aircraft attacked Al Jazeera on the day the Americans entered Baghdad in 2003 and killed the bureau chief with a rocket. So the idea that there'd be a third bombing, this time in Qatar itself, you know, it doesn't frankly surprise me if it's true. What does surprise me is that since the station is effectively run by the emir of Qatar, and since it's the same emir that allows the Americans to operate the biggest U.S. military base in his country, it seems to me like a rather dodgy political prospect to say, well, thanks for letting us have our aircraft take off and land at your airport, but we're going to bomb your major TV station. That seems amazing to me. But, you know, I think one, after 30 years in the Middle East, nothing surprises you anymore. You get used to, and I think it slips by people, but it doesn't slip by us because we live there. You get used to this constant, ever-growing expansion of precedence. I remember a time when Ariel Sharon, as defense minister, years and years ago in Israel, said, oh, there may come a time when we have to shell Ramallah and bomb Gaza. And everyone roared with laughter and said, this will never happen. The guy is mad. And sure enough, Gaza is bombed by aircraft now. You know, we slip through these constant precedents, which become a kind of habit. We now have Iraqi cities and towns being bombed by American aircraft because it's so dangerous. We can't even go and see who they kill. And they'll say, oh, we killed 73 terrorists. And then we see film brought back by Iraqis which have dead women and children. You know, we're going through the precedents now at such a speed that nothing should surprise us anymore.
Are you surprised at all that these documents have been leaked? I mean, first the Downing Street memos and then this transcript of this?
No, I mean, as the conduct of the Iraq war and indeed as the conduct of our politics in the Middle East becomes ever more outrageous, there are going to be good and brave people within the administration who are going to say, getting the truth out is more important than my job or my career, and that always happens. It happened with Vietnam and the New York Times. It happened with Watergate. And it's going to happen with us.
So you think there's British establishment figures who have got quite fed up with...
I don't know if it's the establishment. You know, British leakers tend to be lower middle class civil servants, not people with knighthoods and country palaces. But I think there is, across the spectrum in Britain, not just outrage, but a sense of contempt and disgust for a government which perpetuates lies, and then lies about lies about lies. There comes a point, you know, it's like working with a colleague and you realize that colleague is a bit shifty, and then you realize that colleague has lied to you, and then you realize that colleague will stab you in the back 100 times in order to stay in his job. After a while you say enough is enough, and I think that's what's happened in Britain towards Blair, and it's slowly, in a much slower way, happening in the United States towards Bush, although of course Bush will have to disappear in a couple of years. He can't remain president for another term.
Now, just to change the subject a bit, around the time of the fall of Baghdad, you already mentioned that there was those two attacks. There was the attack on, I didn't mention the second one, there was the attack on the Palestine Hotel, where you were as well, on the same day.
Yeah.
There were reports at the time, sort of shortly after the fall of Baghdad, which suggested that the Republican Guard might have been bought off, and that perhaps some of those attacks on the media were an attempt to try and get the media to off the streets at that time. So
the attack on the Palestine Hotel was a tank. Was a shell fired by a United States tank on the Jumhuriya River Bridge. We know which tank it was, we know the names of the crews, and we know what unit they belong to.
But that, I mean, and there's no, you don't think there's any suggestion that that might have been a deliberate act?
By the Americans, you mean?
Hmm.
Well, they were told that they were under small arms fire from the Palestine Hotel, which was not true. They were not told in the tank itself that the journalists were in that building.
So they were told, what, by radio control?
They were told they were under small arms fire from that building. Now, the problem is that they were not, and indeed they weren't even under small arms fire at that time. I was, quite by chance, because I'd been to a city hospital, I was actually driving between that bridge, between the eastern end of that bridge and the Palestine Hotel, and there was absolutely no shooting at all. If there had been, I wouldn't have been driving along the road. I'd have been hiding in somebody's basement. And not only that, if you look at the French TV3 film of the tank, they were filming this tank long before it fired in continuous tape, and you hear only birds and traffic. There's no shooting. And then the tank fires. So the statement made by General Buford Blount, who's the American commander of that particular unit, that they were under small arms fire is untrue, full stop. There's no way around it. All the evidence, my own eyewitness evidence, proves it's not true. He was not telling the truth.
Do you think it's possible that the Republican Guard were bought off, though, in terms of getting them, that they were evacuated from the city?
I don't think that happened. I think they were withdrawn to the city by Uday Hussein, Saddam's son, with the idea that there'd be some kind of last Stalingrad, and in the end, they went home. They're not home anymore. They're fighting the Americans now. The question is, did Saddam and the hierarchy in Iraq plan the insurgency before the invasion so that the Americans would come in with 148,000 men, including the Brits, and then have to fight the war after they'd captured Baghdad, after they'd occupied the country? Because that's what's happening. The occupation force is fighting the war after the war was supposed to be over.
But you think the insurgents include the remnants of the Republican Guard?
No, let's not use the word remnants. We're not talking about remnants anymore. We're talking about 40,000 insurgents. This is divisions of the Iraqi army that they're fighting. You know, let's forget Al-Qaeda. Well, we can't forget Al-Qaeda, but the Al-Qaeda suicide bombers are something else. They've glommed on to this, and in due course it'll be for the Iraqis to deal with them, because we can't fight Al-Qaeda there. We fail. But the soldiers of the Iran-Iraq war, which lasted from 1980 to 88, who learned to fight and die in the deserts over years and years fighting the Iranians, which were also a superior force, these are the insurgents. I mean, I've talked to them. I've met three of the insurgent commanders, one of whom was a general in the Iraqi army, who walked into the room and said, "Ah, Mr. Robert, we meet again." And I said, "What? We haven't met before." He said, "Yes, we have." He said, "You were under fire on the Iraqi front line outside Basra in 1980, and I took the first Iraqi tank column across the Karun River Bridge, and you climbed on my tank and interviewed me. When I got back to Beirut, I went through my files, and sure enough, I did. Excuse me. So these people, the mainstream of the insurgency are Iraqi soldiers who learned to fight in the Iran-Iraq war, and these are the people the Americans are up against. These are not remnants.
Okay, recently you talked to Tony Jones in Australia about the growing conflict between the Sunnis and the Shiites, and in the course of the interview, I would like to quote you on this. You said, "I'd like to know who's running the Interior Ministry," because you're talking about...
Yes.
"Who's paying the Interior Ministry? Who's paying the gunmen who work for the Interior Ministry? I go to them and I see lots of armed men wearing black leather. Who is paying these guys?" Well, we are. The money isn't falling out of the sky. It's coming from the occupation powers.
Of course.
We need to look at the story in a different light, that the narrative that we're getting, there are death squads and the Iraqis are all going to kill each other. The idea that the whole society is going to commit mass suicide is not possible. It's not logical. There is something else going on. Don't ask me to. And then Tony Jones interrupted you. What were you going to say at that point?
No, I was going to say, don't ask me to say who it is. You see, every time I go to, from my point of view, this is the biggest story. Who is trying to propel Iraq into a civil war, which the people don't want, and it's not natural. There never has been a civil war historically in Iraq. And every time I go to Iraq, I try to find out the answer to this question. And I don't know the answer. And that's why I was going to say, look, don't ask me who it is. One of the unsatisfying things about journalism is that you can express your doubts about the narrative set down by our masters, right? It's all civil war. They hate each other. Only our presence is stopping the civil war. This is what the Brits said about Northern Ireland as a reason for staying, right? And now we do the same there. The unsatisfactory side is that I don't know who wants the civil war. I have a few suspicions, but I can't prove it. And I don't know who's running the death squads, but death squads there are. And when I go to the mortuaries in Baghdad, which I do very often, most of the bodies brought in some days are men and women, and sometimes even children with their hands tied, blindfolded, with bullets in their brains. These are people who have been executed. So there are death squads. And I think the death squads are run by everybody. Everybody has a death squad now, including, you know, the mafia, the insurgents, Al-Qaeda, and I think elements within the Iraqi government, which are, of course, the government which was elected under elections which we arranged and, indeed, which we helped to fund. We fund that government. We, you know, the police and the army are not being, you know, paid by heaven. They're being paid by an institution which is effectively run by us.
Well, does the question then get asked, why aren't the Americans attempting to stop this?
Yeah, well, I don't think the Americans can do anything. The Americans spend their time in their bases trying to stay alive in their little fortresses. The Americans have no power. You've got to understand, you see, why can't they stop it? The Americans can do nothing now. Iraq is gone. The American project is over, with the exception of the Green Zone in the center of Baghdad, which used to be the Republican Palace, where the British Embassy and the American Embassy and the, you know, the government is. From... And with the exception of Kurdistan, from Mosul and Kirkuk and perhaps over in the north, right the way down to Basra, It is now total anarchy. It is out of control. It is a hell disaster, with thousands dying. Iraqis, of course, so we don't care about them, we don't list them, we don't identify them, we don't give them names, we only give names to our dead soldiers, which shows how much we care about ourselves and how little we care about the Iraqis. You can't, I take 2 weeks to plan a trip out of Baghdad by road. The British diplomats will not even travel on the airport road from the embassy to the airport, the main supply route. They go by helicopter. I still do the airport road, and it's horrifying, the number of bombings and shootings that take place there.
So do you have any suspicions about who might be responsible for it?
Yeah, but I can't go on air and say, look, here are my suspicions, but I can't prove it. That's what the Americans do. We believe the Iranians are behind it, but we can't actually give you the proof. We're talking here not about death squads. We're talking about the Iranians being behind the insurgency. We're told the Syrians are behind it, but they won't give us the proof.
I thought Al-Zawahiri was behind the insurgency.
Well, we're told it's Al-Zawahiri. We're told it's the guy who's supposed to have been in northwest Kurdistan and who now runs Al-Qaeda. But I don't know if these people are alive. I don't know if these people are even alive, and nor do the Americans, frankly. American intelligence is totally blinded. They have no idea what's happening in Iraq. It's quite clear. You know, you keep hearing, oh, so-and-so was kidnapped by men dressed in police uniforms, or a police station was taken over by men dressed in army uniforms. Don't tell me there's a warehouse in Fallujah with 8,000 police and military uniforms for the insurgents. No, these people are the army. They are the police. The security forces are working for the insurgency. That's the point.
Okay.
And that's why the Americans can't get out.
There's been quite a lot of reporting about the rescue of those two soldiers in Basra. There's quite a lot of speculation about what they were up to.
I wasn't in Iraq then, and I agree with you. What were they up to with weapons in plain clothes, pretending to be Arabs? It's very odd, very weird, and I obviously remembered that that's the kind of thing the SAS, the British SAS, did in Northern Ireland. But I don't know the answer to your question because I wasn't there, and that wasn't my story at the time.
In terms of the British situation there, I mean, Basra, they're obviously quite precarious. Do you think that they will be forced to withdraw shortly?
Look, if you have a heavily armed army and you're backed up with air power, you don't have to withdraw. But the issue is, what happens when you come to the point when your presence is simply worthless and your casualties are for nothing? That's what the Americans and British are facing now. It's not a question of forced to withdraw. I mean, I could imagine that with 40,000 insurgents and a lot of planning, it might be possible for the insurgents to actually take over a small American base. But you're dealing with a very, very heavily armed force with the United States, and the same with the Brits. So you're not going to have, you know, Basra's British bases captured by insurgents. Well, I don't think you are. Mm. What you are going to have is this, you know, this political drip, drip, drip of why are we there? What's the point? Why are we taking casualties? Why is this sergeant going home dead to his family? For what? When the whole of Iraq has gone. I mean, the Brits, for example, claim they control, quote-unquote, the city of Amara. Not Samara, but Amara. Mm. And if you go there, they live in a base where they're totally cut off and sometimes need helicopter resupplying with emergency rations because they're under mortar fire. And once a day, they run an armored patrol through the town with the permission of the local tribesmen. And they claim they control Amara.
Okay. Now, to move on to the subject of Iran, I mean, in one of the last chapters of your book, I think it's called The Dyer's Cast, you talk at length about the process that led up to the war and the sort of the inevitability of it.
Yeah.
A lot of very similar things are now happening in terms of public statements about Iran.
Yes, but it's different. You see, the Americans, when they arrived in Baghdad, I was in Baghdad, I saw them come, and we didn't know if they were going to turn right to Tehran or turn left to Damascus. Hmm. They were in overdrive. They were, with the arrogance of power, they thought they could do anything. And now, of course, with this massive insurgency, this painful, devastating war that they're still fighting, the Americans are in no position to invade Iran or invade Syria or indeed invade anyone else in the Middle East.
What about airstrikes, particularly by the Israelis against
Israel? Oh, no, by the Israelis it is possible. They talk about it, and we know that, you know, very often because of the relationship between Israel and the United States, which is basically turns them into the same country. I mean, there's no, if you get Israel's policies and America's foreign policies in the Middle East and you mix them all up, you won't be able to disentangle them. You won't know which is Israeli or which is American. It is conceivable the Israelis might stage an airstrike. It is possible.
But is it? I mean, given what we're seeing in terms of public rhetoric, is the stage being set to justify that?
Well, you see, it's all being done for us. This is part of the narrative of history laid down and current events laid down by our bosses, by our presidents and prime ministers and our generals, and I'm afraid by our journalists too. Look, the real threat in the Middle Eastern area, in Southwest Asia, is a very extreme Muslim state, which is highly precarious, which has many, many Al-Qaeda people in it, which has a nuclear weapon.
Pakistan.
It's called Pakistan. But we don't look at that. We talk about Iran, which doesn't have a nuclear weapon, as being a greater threat than a highly unstable Islamist state like Pakistan, which does have a nuclear threat because it has nuclear weapons. And Bush goes and puts his arm around Musharraf, the president general dictator of Pakistan, and says, this is our friend in the war on terror. But in fact, the real danger, the real nuclear danger in the Middle East is not Iran, it is Pakistan. But because we journalists and we people dutifully follow our leaders, we still think it's Iran. It's not Iran, it's Pakistan.
Well, Pakistan's, that's an interesting, good segue into the next question, which is about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the evidence that was given to the 9/11 Commission about what happened on September the 11th. I mean, basically our narrative of what happened on September the 11th has been shaped by the alleged evidence of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
No, I tell you, there's so much secrecy about what happened on September 11th, 2001, that I don't think we know. This is, of course, we know the most secretive U.S. administration in history. But there are so many questions we don't know. When did Bush really learn, first of all, about the attacks? How come we're not allowed to hear the air traffic control conversations with the aircraft which came down in Pennsylvania? There are so many questions to be asked and so many answers which are unforthcoming, that we still don't really understand what happened on September 11th. I mean, you take the letter that Mohammed Atta, the chief hijacker, supposedly wrote for the other hijackers. Sections of that letter make sense in a Muslim sense. He was saying to them, you know, here is the end of fun and games, we have to, etc. But other parts of that letter appear to be incomprehensible. Every Arab Muslim I know who's read it says, I don't believe that all this letter was written by him. So we have even here a vital piece of evidence in which many people feel that some of that evidence is correct, but maybe some of it was tampered with. I don't know, and I don't understand why. And, you know, since I'm based in Beirut, I can't, you know, I can't do the 9/11 story in New York or Washington. I can ask questions, but I don't know the answers. But I think that, you know, we don't really know what happened on 9/11 still. We have many questions we still ask. Now, I suppose it's conceivable the US intelligence authorities don't know. They certainly screwed it up. As usual, they didn't know it was going to happen, though they had the evidence if they wanted to find out. But I think that, you know, we're going to learn more in the months and years to come. The question is, how many years will it take? Because you know what happens with governments? They have some ghastly secret. Or indeed, Bin Laden might have a ghastly secret. And by the time it comes out in 20 years' time, we have other crises and worse crises to deal with, and it just becomes a historical footnote. You know, at the time of the overthrow of Mossadegh, the prime minister democratically elected of Iran, the world believed that popular crowds had overthrown him. It was years later that the details of a complex but real CIA MI6 plot to overthrow him came out, in which, you know, Kim Roosevelt was the CIA chief and the British MI6 chief involved, who's given me a full interview before he died, Colonel Monty Woodhouse, were planning the overthrow with weapons and money of the democratically elected Prime Minister of Iran. But it took so long for the details to come out that when they did come out, they were only of historic interest, you see. What we need is to know the details now. We need more leaks and whistleblowers, and unfortunately, there are not many of them around.
Well, there is a lot of peculiar stuff coming up about 9/11. I mean, there's certainly a lot of people that are attempting to dig into it. But
yes, I know that. And many people are now saying, oh, the U.S. administration must have been involved, but they can't prove it. And the problem is, you know, in the Arab world, for example, everywhere I go, every story I write, every dispatch I file, someone will tell you about the plot. Al-Mu'amara in Arabic. I always think there should be a separate chair in an interview for the plot to sit in when you're interviewing somebody. And there are plots, they do exist, but I don't think that everything that happens is a result of a conspiracy.
There's an inherent problem in that theory, though. I mean, on the one hand, there are probably some people who feel that Osama bin Laden's attack on the West was a defining moment in terms of the...
Yeah, but you see, I don't go along with this defining moment. In 1982, in the Palestinian refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila, Israel's Lebanese Christian allies murdered up to 1,700 civilians, more than half the total of the World Trade Center. Okay? Mm-hmm. And no one lit candles for them. No U.S. president went and stood at the mass grave. Nobody said that these murders changed the world forever. Nobody said it was a defining moment. They were just more Arab Muslims being murdered. And I am against the idea of believing that 9/11 was a defining moment, that it was that it changed the world forever. Because the moment you say it's a defining moment, it allows you to change the law, to cut back on, to throw away international law, to dispose of human rights, to introduce torture. Mm. I'm not going to let 19 Arab murderers change my world, and nor should you, frankly. No. But Bush wants it to change our world. He wants to give them that credit. In this way, you see, the Bin Ladens and the Bushes work together.
Well, yeah, I think that's the question. I mean, if there are elements within, say, Arab society who saw the attacks on the United States as something of a fight back, how can they also consider that somehow the Bush administration might have been involved in them?
No, look, I don't think Arabs think the Bush administration was involved at all. It's we who suspect that there may have been some kind of cover-up by the American government. I mean, I don't believe the U.S. administration was involved in destroying the World Trade Center for a moment. I think it's ridiculous. But that there certainly are a lot of secrets about it which are being maintained by the U.S. authorities is without question. It's a fact. Mm. You know, Arab Muslims don't believe in crashing airplanes into tall buildings, but what they do believe is that the U.S. has militarily come to control the Middle East, as Bin Laden says it has, and they want that control to end, as Bin Laden says it should. And many Arabs will tell you, look, thank you for giving us democracy if we want it. Thank you so much for all those human rights, but we'd like freedom from you. And when Bin Laden speaks, they hear him say that. Mm. That doesn't mean that, you know, again, that doesn't mean that Arab Muslims believe in violence or crashing planes into buildings. But Bin Laden, when he speaks politically, undoubtedly says things which millions of Arabs agree with, and which their own presidents, like Mubarak and King Abdullah of Jordan and so on, who basically work for us, will not say.
Hmm. Now, the final couple of questions is about the media. Your role in terms of reporting from the Middle East, often you're out on your own, really, in terms of the...
Well, I work on my own. I don't work with other journalists either.
But the views you express are often often different than that which we're receiving from a lot of
mainstream newspapers. Mainstream. Yes, of course.
Do you have any views about what can be done about the inadequacy of the media, and what media do you use yourself?
You mean what do I read?
Mm.
Oh, the Independent, of course. My own newspaper.
Yeah.
Look, I think the point is this. I had a conversation more than 2 years ago with that very fine Israeli journalist, Amira Haas, who works for Haaretz. And we were discussing what was the point of being a foreign correspondent, what was our job. And I said, look, our job is to write the first pages of history and to make sure that no one can say when we've seen something terrible, no one told us we didn't know. And she said, no, Robert, our job is to monitor the centers of power, to challenge authority, especially when it goes to war, especially when it's going to kill people, and especially when it's going to tell lies to do it. And that, I think, is the best definition I've ever heard of what our job is, or what our job should be. And that's what I try to do. Mm. And you will suffer the outrage of prime ministers and generals, and indeed your own colleagues, to do that. It's much easier to go along with the narrative. 9/11 changed the world forever, for example. How many journalists simply accepted that? I don't accept it. It's a lie. It must not, and we must not let it.
But is the corporatization of the media part of the problem?
I think it's a question of laziness, isn't it? Look, in the United States, the problem is that there is an osmotic, parasitic relationship between journalists and power. Journalists love power. They have to be close to power. They like access to power. You only have to watch a presidential press conference at the White House to see how it works. All those journalists say, Mr. President, Mr. President, they've all got questions, right? Mr. President! And then the president says, yes, Bob. Yes, Chris. Yes, John.
Mm.
Yeah. That's how the relationship works. And I think this goes back to the McCarthyite era. And you only have to watch that wonderful film about Ed Murrow that's just come out, Good Night and Good Luck, to see how you end up with a situation where journalists who challenge their country's foreign policy in time of war are seen as not only being unpatriotic, but potentially subversive.
Hmm.
And the moment you challenge Israel and Israeli actions, however brutal or unbrutal they may be, you will be called anti-Semitic, which is a lie. I mean, the people who use the words anti-Semitic against any critic of Israel are going to end up making that phrase respectable. There are plenty of real anti-Semites out there in the world whom all of us must be against. But this phrase, which is used to cow and batter journalists who are trying to tell the truth about the Middle East, is outrageous.
Hmm. Now, the Internet's provided something of an alternative avenue for informing people.
Now, the Internet has also provided a system of hate. I've seen websites, I don't use the internet or email, but I've seen websites shown to me by other people where people are encouraging other people to kill me.
That's true, but millions of people...
Well, don't say a but, you mean that's true full stop, that's a problem, isn't it? It's a problem for me if it's not for you.
No, it's a problem for all of us, but I mean, at the same time, millions of people have access to your reports who previously...
Yes, I realise that, of course, and that's why I get more than half my mailbag from the United States, not from Britain. Because they're reading on the internet, aren't they? Yes, of course they are.
I mean, your reports even termed the term fisking, which was invented around your name, which is to criticise media and blogging.
Well, I tell you frankly, I'm not interested in blogger pops. I've got too much work to do, and I think I really don't waste my time on that stuff.
The internet's not something that you really read or use.
I don't use the internet. I don't know how to. I don't Google or Woogle or whatever you're supposed to do, and I don't use email. All my files and archives are on paper, and it works.
Okay. Final question. What happens next?
It gets worse. I see no sign that the Western powers understand the extent of injustice in the Middle East or the need to correct it. As long as we go on thinking that we can fight and use military power against our enemies, and that this will solve the problem, we will have worse to come. Unless we deal with the major political issues of injustice right across the Middle East, this will become what Bush calls a war that will not end. You know, thanks very much, George. Great news for our great-grandchildren. That's what he actually said, this war may never end. It won't unless we deal with it like grown-ups. But as long as we think we can solve it with Apache helicopters and F-16s and M1A1 Abrams tanks and Humvees and Bradley armored vehicles and tens and tens and tens of thousands of soldiers, it will not end.
Mm. Well, thank you very much, Robert, and
you're welcome.
Welcome to Peaceful New Zealand.
Thanks.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.